So let's talk about SE Hop, and this is one we actually do care more about because it's a stronger control. Matt Miller, I believe, Scape, he was the first one that kind of came up with this idea, and I may be wrong. I know he works at Microsoft, but I believe when he got hired on, that's kind of when they were implementing this particular control, and he's one of the brilliant minds at Microsoft kind of leading the exploit mitigation research going on there. So again, it stands for Structured Exception Handling Overflow or Overwrite Protection, I believe is the appropriate one. It started with Windows Vista at Service Pack 1 and Server 2008. It usually would be turned on by Emmet, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, though you could also do it in the registry. So it really wasn't a highly utilized control. And what it does is it protects Windows 32-bit processes. So 64-bit, the structured exception handling, the way that works is a little different. It's not, the pointers aren't on the stack like we saw in the first module of this book. They're in the header area. But this control, quite strong. You can defeat it, but it requires like you to already be on the system, and it requires memory layout in the stack to be a certain way, and you've got to find this particular gadget. It's a really but a bit of a pain. But you can do it, and the technique is documented on the internet as well as in Gray Hat Hacking series. So by the way, let's take a look at what it looks like on a system. So I'm going to go to this Windows 7 system that I've got. Let me find it real quick. And I've got Emmet here. So let's kill that. Now before, if you remember, in the prior module, we took a look at structured exception handling a little bit. So let's just look at the before and after real quick. I'm going to bring up Immunity Debugger, and this is going to be before the control is turned on. So we'll bring up Immunity, and we'll bring up Internet Explorer, because that's the browser installed on Windows 7 by default. And I'll just let it start. Just give it a moment for the browser to pop up. And once it pops up, we're going to go and just grab a random thread. So I click on T, just double click on a random thread. And then if you look down on the stack, and we did this before, you see pointer to next SEH record. So let's scroll down a bit. So this pointer to next SEH record is what the FS offset 0 points to for this thread. So the address that FS offset 0 would point to is on the left of this, it's the actual stack address. And at that address, you can see is a pointer on that same stack, but to the next NSEH pointer. So this is kind of, you can refer to it as the linked list of structured exception handlers on this thread stack. It's just pointers down the stack to the next one. Below it is what we really care about. That's the pointer to what should be the DLL exception handling code. So if we right click on that and say follow in disassembler, it takes us in this case to kernel base to the beginning of a handler. But if we click on or right click on pointer to next SEH, that's NSEH, and say follow and stack, that takes us to, in this case, the very last one. And we know it's the last one because it's negative one. And it says end of SEH chain. That means the pointer below, it's going to point to NTDLL, and that's just going to terminate the process. That's with SEHOP off. Now let's kill this, and we'll bring up Emmet in this case because there's no exploit guard on Windows 7. And I'm going to click on apps. And you can see the only one I've gotten there. I know it's kind of small, but it's Internet Explorer. And I'm going to click on SE Hop Control. And I'm going to say OK, refresh, and then let's minimize that and bring up Immunity again. And we'll start up Internet Explorer just as we did before. I'm going to try to not let it, I'm hoping there's enough threads started without letting it continue. There's only two. Let's give it a shot. If we have to start it, we will. So here's the pointer to the next SEH record on the stack. And you can see in this case, because it's probably an early thread, it's in a different memory location. Let me just let it start up and do it the slow way, but more effective way. All right, there we go. Let's click on a random thread. And we'll scroll down. So here's a pointer to the next SEH record. This is the first one on the stack. And you can see it points on the same stack. So everything looks the same there. We right click, follow and stack. Now notice that this one at the bottom here doesn't point to the same stack. So what would have probably been negative one, FFFFFFFF, now points to some other memory location that's not on the same stack. That's SE hop control. So if we right click on it and say follow and dump, there's that negative one that we're expecting to see. And next to it is some address. That address is going to point inside Emmet. to the SE hop little code there. So let's go to that address, control G, 70D1E3F7. We say okay. And I know you can barely see it, but at the very top it says module emmet. So we're at emmet.dll. And you see the instructions starting with XOR EAX EAX down to increment EAX return 10, and then that's it. So we're zeroing out the accumulator register, incrementing it by 1, basically probably setting a flag, and then returning back. And it says, if we made it here, then that means we were able to walk the linked list of exception handlers. So to put this all together, imagine if we were an attacker and we overwrote one of those pointers on the stack like we will in this book. If we overwrote a SE handler pointer, then if the SE hop control, before it lets you go to the first handler or what should be the first handler, it walks the linked list to make sure that it can get to this code and set that flag accordingly and that everything looks the way it should. If it can reach this code by walking the linked list of exception handlers, that means the linked list is not corrupt. It means it wasn't overwritten by an attacker. If it can't, so if you're an attacker and you overrun a buffer and overwrite that first, and the thread just died, it's funny, and you overwrite that first handler on the stack to try to get control, when SE hop tries to walk the linked list of NSCH pointers, it doesn't make it here. And that's how it catches you. All right, let's go back out. So visual C++ GS check, super easy one. This is stack canaries, but they call it security cookies on Windows. It's a Visual Studio control that was added a long time ago, I think like 2005 or something, and it's gotten more aggressive as time went on, because originally I think it only put a stack canary or cookie when there was a string buffer associated with it, but there were quite a few vulnerabilities that came out over the years that found that not to be effective enough. An example would be like the animated cursor bug that came out in 2007, where a function that was vulnerable, it was compiled with GS, but it wasn't protected because compiler didn't think it needed to be. But in fact, it did need to be. So they're more aggressive now. Windows uses a random canary. So a random canary is selected once per process invocation, but it adds an additional check where it XORs the canary against the base pointer during the function prolog to give it some uniqueness, make it more difficult to guess for an attacker. So PEV randomization, we talked about the PEV earlier. It's the process environment block. It's one per process when it starts up. It stores information about where the loaded DLLs are in memory, the heap information, so on and so forth. The reason it's interesting to attackers is that there's writable pointers in there. At least historically, there have been writable pointers. And if it's at a static location, we can overwrite a pointer, basically hooking it. And when that pointer is called by the process, the attacker gets their code executed. So obviously it's a good target. Now, they started randomizing it pretty early on. And when they initially randomized it, it was one of 16 locations because for whatever reason, it had to be way down in high memory and user mode. I don't quite know what the dependency was. But later on in Windows 10, it's randomized much more greatly. It's more difficult for an attacker to know where it is. It's still utilized by shellcode because if we dereference offset 30 in the TIB for a thread, we can reach it. And the reason we like it is because the module load addresses are there and shellcode wants that. And we'll get to that later on in this book. Heap cookies. So early on, Windows and XP Service Pack 2 added in heap cookies. And it works similar to security cookies. But the thing about security cookies on the stack or stack canaries is that when we do function prolog, when a function gets called, it gets pushed onto the stack. And when we do epilog from that function before we ret, we check the canary to make sure it looks good. So it's a logical position for it to be stored, and we won't continue execution if the canary or cookie has been compromised. And it's very fast because, again, we're just executing a couple lines of code during epilog and prolog. So on the heap, imagine if we, as a chunk, it's allocated in memory with something like heap alloc. If we were to put a canary on every single chunk, when are we going to check it? Because there are going to be thousands of chunks out there in dynamic memory. We can't just check it every single function epilog or something. It doesn't make sense. It'd be too much overhead. So when these cookies that are put into the metadata of chunks are checked is normally in things like during allocation and deletion. It's not just going to randomly check these cookies to make sure they haven't been compromised. So if an attacker finds a heap overflow and they overwrite five chunks metadata, compromising five security cookies or heap cookies, they may not get caught unless one of those chunks that have been compromised are checked due to something like an allocation or deletion. So 8 bits of entropy when it first came out, so obviously that's pretty weak entropy, and the reason it's such low entropy is because they were only able to leverage 1 byte of the heap metadata, of the chunk metadata that wasn't needed. So in order to get better entropy, they actually moved and rewrote the heap allocator to low fragmentation heap, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So safe unlinking, we're not going to dive too much into this because we don't really get into heap exploitation, but unlinking is something that happens relative to the heap and chunks of memory that have been freed. So let's keep it high level and walk through what we need to. When you allocate chunks of memory, which can be different sizes, on the heap, that's dynamic memory, they're in use, right? We're currently using them. And then when we no longer need them, we call a free function and we free those chunks of memory and give them back to the heap manager. And the reason behind that is we want to reuse space that we no longer need before asking the kernel to commit more physical resources to it for us. So we recycle this memory as it gets freed and allocated and freed and allocated. When those chunks of memory get freed, we need to be able to track them somehow. So they get put into this doubly linked list where there are these pointers, forward link and backward link pointers, that point to each other. So all the chunks that are freed on this free list are pointing to each other. And if an allocation request comes in, we can go to check and see if a chunk of a certain size is available on a free list and get that reallocated. So unlinking is the process of removing or unlinking a chunk from a doubly linked free list that we're going to put back into use again. When we remove a chunk from one of these free lists, we need to update the pointers accordingly so the list doesn't get broken and that the chunks are properly pointing to other free chunks. So with safe unlinking, what we're doing, and this is a little bit of macro code you see on the screen now, we're saying, okay, let's define the unlink macro and let's initialize these values, variables. P is going to be the chunk that we are unlinking from the free list. So in other words, the chunk that's currently free and not in use, but we want to put back into use, P is going to be the address of that chunk. BK is going to be the address that the chunk we are unlinking's backward pointer. So whatever chunk on the same free list that it points back to, that's going to be BK. And whatever chunk in memory that P, the chunk we're unlinking's forward pointer points to, that's going to be FD. So we've already done the first couple lines of code. So we've got P, the chunk we're unlinking, BK, the chunk we're unlinking's backward pointer, and FD, the chunk we're unlinking's forward pointer. And on the right, you can kind of see what we're referring to there. Then we need to update the pointers. In other words, the chunk that we're pointing to backwards, we need to go to that chunk and update its forward pointer so that it no longer points to the chunk we're unlinking, but instead the backward pointer's forward pointer now points to the chunk that the chunk we're unlinking's forward pointer was pointing to. And I know that's a lot of words and it's kind of confusing, but just look at the diagram on the right of the slide. You see it says forward pointer. We want to take that pointer and update the backward pointer's forward pointer position so that it points to a chunk that's not in use. We don't want the back chunk to point to the chunk we're unlinking anymore because it's going to be in use. We don't want it to point there. It's going to be broken if it does. And we need to go to FD and update its backward pointer so that it points to a chunk that's also not in use. All we're trying to do is safely remove a chunk from a doubly linked free list that we're putting back into use. And in order to do that, we need to update the pointers of the surrounding chunk so they're not pointing to this chunk we're unlinking anymore. So the problem with the code on this screen is that it doesn't do any pointer validation prior to unlinking. It just assumes that nothing is corrupt. On this slide, we solve that problem. So look at the code in the middle. It says if the forward pointers or the forward chunk's backward pointer position is not pointing to P, and remember, P is the chunk we're unlinking. So again, we're going to FD, which is pointed to by the chunk we're unlinking. and we're saying, okay, FD chunk, does your backward pointer point to P, the chunk we're unlinking? If not, throw an exception. And then it says, or go to BK, which is the chunk we're unlinking's backward pointer position, go to that address, check its forward pointer to make sure it's pointing to P, the chunk we're unlinking. If not, throw an exception. So if either of those is not true, we terminate the process. Otherwise, we do the unlinking and update the pointers accordingly. And just based on that explanation of those last couple slides, you can see that the heap is more complex. And that's just one little, you know, one taste of it. So the low fragmentation heap, this is the front end allocator replacement, which used to be the look aside list in user land. So in user land, we had the look aside list all the way up till Windows Vista, and then it got replaced sometime around, I believe it was available in XP Service Pack 3 or something, but it wasn't really used. But for all intents and purposes, what we care about is that Vista is when the LFH really took over as the front end allocator, and the look aside list was deprecated at that point. The look aside list still used in the kernel, but the low fragmentation heap replaced it as a front end allocator in user land. And so what's front end allocator mean? The front end allocator, it's faster to service a request from the front end allocator. There's less code to get a chunk from that allocator than is the doubly linked back end allocator. Now with that may come some security concerns. We're not going to dive deep into this. If you have, you know, if you're curious about LFHs, there's plenty of resources. Look up some information from Tarjay Mant or who else would be, or Chris Valasek would be another one who's done some great research over the years on the low fragmentation heap. But what I wanted to point out here is, see where it says 32-bit chunk encoding? I just was complaining about the fact that the entropy on security cookies of the heap cookies on Windows XP was 8 bits. Well, now it's 32 bits because we XOR the first 32 bits of metadata in a chunk with a cookie value, you can refer to it as. So when a chunk gets allocated, we XOR the first 32 bits of its metadata. And that way, if an attacker were to overwrite that chunk, when that chunk goes to get accessed and we XOR the canary against the first 32 bits, and now it's been overwritten, it's going to be corrupt, right? It's not going to convert back or XOR back to what it should look like. And then we can throw an exception. So it does some of that. And again, LFH services requests that for commonly used chunk sizes. So let's say, for example, you're in a browser and you go to a web page like CNN.com, there's going to be lots of HTML objects in there, right? Like span elements and divs and tables. And when those particular objects are used often, they're the same size. And so it makes sense to service requests more quickly for that particular size. And we don't have to worry about fragmentation as much either because we're constantly using that size. So we don't do any coalescing and such on the low fragmentation heap like we do in the back end. But it's got to be triggered, again, as you see at the bottom, after 18 consecutive allocations of the same size, then that particular size will be serviced by the low fragmentation heap. So address space layout randomization, this one we're pretty familiar with. It began on the Windows world on Windows Vista. It randomizes applications, it randomizes DLLs once per boot, it randomizes the heap and the stack. Now things like the image itself and DLLs, they have to be compiled to support rebasing, so the dynamic base flag has to be used. On 32-bit, you can imagine the entropy is not going to be as great. We don't have as many bits to utilize. On 64-bit, we can leverage something called high entropy ASLR, which gives us a lot more randomization in the pool. So ASLR, it's gotten a lot better on Windows Vista and 7. It's not as good as it is on Windows 8 and 10. In the kernel world, things like driver entropy and such, and randomization there is way less in 32-bit world than it is in 64-bit world. So you really want to be on a 64-bit OS. Defeating ASLR, similar to how we talked about in the Linux world, how many tries do we get? Can we go after older operating systems? Are there information leak opportunities or information disclosure opportunities? Can we spray the heap? You know, what types of things can we do to kind of reduce the entropy or get some predictability and other factors? So we talked a bit about Exploit Guard and Emmet already. As I mentioned, Emmet was end of life in July 31st, 2018. And when they first announced that it's end of life, people got upset and they said, well, we implemented this thing and now you're not going to support it. That's not cool. We really depend on this product. And so Microsoft did the right thing and they came out and said, well, with Windows 10, we are offering Exploit Guard. And I believe it started out on enterprise only. You had to have a certain build version, but it's a bit more available now. Again, you've got to go and test applications to make sure, one, it doesn't break them, and two, the overhead isn't too much. And these are user land exploit mitigations. These aren't kernel land mitigations. Kernel has its own set of mitigations, some of which are similar, but you don't control those with Exploit Guard. So isolated heap and Internet Explorer and Edge protections. Back in 2014, it's crazy how time flies, but 2014, June and July, Microsoft came out with these new mitigations called deferred free and isolated heap. And they didn't give any warning and they were targeting Edge and Internet Explorer. And the idea was that the bug class known as use after free and type confusion, these were dynamic memory vulnerabilities and typically associated with C++, which the browser and DLLs are primarily written in. And so when an object, without going into too much detail, even though I say that and then I go into detail, it's just hard not to at times. Let's use a quick example. If you know C++, you understand object-oriented programming. And when an object gets created, you're basically instantiating an instance of a class, right? So you create this object, and there are these member functions or methods that travel around with the object. And then you would say object X dot method name to do something on that object. And so you're utilizing these references to the object. And when you get to something that's complex, like a browser or a word processing application, tracking dynamic memory and objects can get quite difficult, if not impossible. So take something like a browser, and we create some object using JavaScript, which is only talking to a C++ class underneath. And you instantiate this object, create an instance of the object, and then you append it as a child node to the document body, and then you create an additional object and you append that to a node and you set its internal HTML or inner HTML. There's all these things you can do that are causing references to be made to that object. Well, that gets difficult to track. So C++ or something called smart pointers that you can utilize, and smart pointers does dynamic reference tracking. And there's an add ref function and a release function to kind of, when a new reference gets created, we add it. When we don't need it anymore, we release it. Well, there's a reference counter, and that reference counter gets decremented to zero eventually when we call release enough times. And that's supposed to indicate that the object can get given back to the heap. We're done with it and we can reuse that memory. So an attacker wants to try and prematurely decrement that reference counter to zero because the process still needs that object. But if the attacker can trick the object into thinking it's no longer needed, they can then reallocate that memory. And then when the process goes to utilize what it thinks is that object, it's actually an attacker-controlled object. And that would be a use after free condition. Well, that was a big problem and still is for Microsoft, especially in the browser world. And every month in Patch Tuesday, there were like 20, 30 vulnerabilities being patched. And so they had to do something, and they introduced isolated heaps to try to isolate critical objects so that they're not easily reachable by attackers. So if an attacker is able to prematurely free that object like they did previously, then when they go to reallocate that memory, their allocation ends up in the default process heap and not in the isolated heap. So they can't easily do the same attack. That would be deferred free. I'm sorry, isolated heap. And then deferred free would be when the object, a reference counter gets decremented to zero. Just because it's decremented to zero doesn't mean it automatically goes back to the heap manager anymore. A threshold of 100,000 bytes to be freed up has to be met, as well as there needs to not be any references to that object being freed on the stack. And then they added in memgc, which really hurt the ability for attackers to exploit a lot of these bugs, because they also check all the other objects to make sure that there are no objects with an active reference to the object being freed. Because if there is an active reference in an object to an object that's being freed, something's wrong and it will terminate the process. So this really did do a good job mitigating a lot of these vulnerabilities. And I put into a Gray Hat Hacking 5th edition an example of a USAFTA free bug in a browser, like in an Explorer 11 and Edge, that's not protected by MemGC because it's not a HTML object that's involved. It's instead a text allocation. So therefore it's not protected the same way, depending on what, you know, application you're looking at. So neat stuff. So Control Flow Guard is a pretty powerful control, but you know, when Microsoft came out with this control, they were pretty, I mean, they were actually saying that we're getting rid of Emmet, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. And one of the reasons you need not worry is because Control Flow Guard is such a strong control that it mitigates most of the vulnerabilities out there from being exploitable. And that's just not really true. And, you know, if you follow Project Zero and folks like Tavis Ormandy, I mean, just a few months ago, he found a vulnerability, and I think it was ctf.dll or something, but this particular vulnerability that he found, he was able to get around Control Flow Guard by exploiting some of the weaknesses of it. What it does from a high level is it reduces the number of usable ROP gadgets that an attacker can use. Now, we'll talk about the way it does that, but it doesn't get rid of them, but it reduces them greatly. And how it works is at compile time, so it's got to be supported by the operating system and the compiler, but at compile time, a table is built. So it's a bitmap, actually. So imagine a checkerboard. So a checkerboard with a bunch of, you know, dots or squares. And each square within that checkerboard represents or tic-tac-toe board, whatever. Each square represents a block of memory that's aligned. So it may be, let's say, a page of memory, 4,096 bytes. So every square represents a page of addressing in that DLL. And then if a function's entry point exists within one of those blocks of memory in the squares, then that's going to get marked as an entry point that you're allowed to jump to indirectly. So if you have a jump to an indirect jump, like a jump to the pointer in EAX or RAX, that's an indirect call. So we call that. If the address we're calling falls within one of those blocks of memory that's been identified as having a function entry point, then it allows it to continue. But there's also going to be a lot of squares in that checkerboard or tic-tac-toe board that where a function entry point doesn't exist. And if a function entry point doesn't exist within that block of addressing, then Control Flow Guard prevents you from being able to indirectly jump to that location of memory. It'll say, no, there are no function entry points within this memory block, so why would you ever be going to it directly, you know, as a start point of a function? Because there is no start point of a function there. So I know that's maybe a bit complicated, but it's a good control, but it's not like the one that's going to fix all of our problems. And we can get around it through like JIT code, just-in-time compiled code. We can get around it by finding if there's a function entry point that exists within a memory block and we identify ROP gadgets that are useful within that same memory block, we can use that for return-oriented programming. So control flow integrity, this is something Intel released a paper back in June 2016, and they said they were thinking about implementing shadow stacks and indirect branch tracking. And it's nothing new. People have been talking about this type of control for a long time, but this would be a processor or hardware enforced control. Very simple concept. You know that a call instruction puts the return pointer onto the stack and then redirects execution to the called function. Well, when the call instruction pushes that return pointer onto the stack, it also will push a shadow copy of that return pointer into a hardware protected area of memory. And the only instruction that's permitted to do that is the call instruction. So now there's a copy of the return pointer on a hardware protected shadow stack. If an attacker overwrites the return pointer, when the RET instruction goes to execute, then the active stack is going to have a different address because it's been overwritten than what's on the shadow stack, and therefore you get caught. Simple. The other one is the control flow integrity with indirect branch tracking. This one's a real simple concept as well. When you think about returning back from a function call, we return to the return pointer, right? The address that's supposed to be back in the caller's memory space. So we have a call instruction, we call function X, and then the next address after the call instruction would serve as the return pointer. Now let's pretend that the instruction at the return pointer location is XOR RAX RAX. So we want to zero out their accumulator register when we return back from the function. That's what we would expect to see. What the indirect branch tracking does is it moves that instruction one down. So it's still there, it just moves it down, and it replaces what would have been that at the return pointer position with an instruction that says end branch 32 or end branch 64. And that instruction really is benign. It doesn't do anything. It's like a knob. But the point is it has to be there. So when you return back from a function call, anytime the return instruction executes, it must point to the address of an end branch instruction. And then it executes the end branch instruction, which does nothing, but it has to be there. And then we do the XOR operation. So you see how that's going to hurt return-oriented programming, because we rely on the RET instruction so much, but we're not returning to end branch instructions. We're returning to whatever gadget is meaningful to us. So it will significantly limit the number of usable ROP gadgets. So pretty good stuff, but you know, luckily not really there yet. So kernel hardening, just to point out, we're not getting into kernel space here in this course, but there's a lot of controls that have been implemented over the years with the later kernel versions to do the same thing we've been doing in user land. In user land, it's safer to implement these controls because overhead on one process, no big deal. Overhead on the kernel, bad. Exploit mitigations break things sometimes. Breaking Firefox for a minute, no big deal. Breaking the kernel, you're going to blue screen. So there's been reasons as to why these haven't been implemented as much in the kernel. Also, kernel exploitation generally is harder than user land exploitation. So they've added things like null pointer dereference protection, which I mentioned, guard pages, which are simply pages of memory that you're not allowed to access. And if you access it, you trigger a fault. Improved randomization, like I mentioned, kernel pool cookies as well. So that gets us to the end of this module. As you can see, there's a lot of really great controls out there. You just need to understand from a defensive perspective which ones are there to protect you, and from an exploitation perspective, which ones you're up against and have to try to defeat or circumvent or avoid. Well, same thing. And then I would recommend, if you're interested in this stuff, you know, go further and start researching Exploit Guard and experiment with how those different mitigations work and such. Okay, so let's get started on our first exercise on Windows overflows. In this particular module, it's broken up into two exercises. The first one is a basic stack overflow, and then the second one is a structured exception handling overwrite. So our target here is a program or application called Blaze Video HDTV Player 6.6 Pro. Now let me just tell you a little bit about this and why I selected this one as our target. Back before, when Windows XP was still around, what I had in this course was a program called War FTP. It was just a third-party FTP server, and it allowed you to send across the wire a malicious FTP packet, and you could take control of the remote system. So remote exploitation means one of two things. If you can send network traffic over to a target system that's reachable, and exploit a service and get remote code execution, that's fantastic. I mean, from an exploitation perspective, that's what we want. Now, it used to be a long time ago that many more services were exposed out to the internet and reachable, but that's just not the way it is anymore. It's very rare that we get a true service-side exploit. And going back to like MS-03026, which was MSRPC DCOM bug with Blaster, and then the LSAS vulnerability, SASER, and MS-08067, you can count a lot of these on one or two hands as to how many true remote server-side exploits there were. And of course, more recently with things like Eternal Blue and others out there, they're just rare and they're worth a ton of money if you have one. If you were to find one and you wanted to sell it to a potential buyer, depending on who the buyer is, you could get paid 6 to 7 figures for that. So a lot of money can be made because they're so difficult to find. But what is also almost, if not just as good, are remote exploits where you have a malicious document and you phish to someone, and if they open the document, it exploits the application and gets you remote code execution and connectivity that way. You set up your command and control. Those are more likely to be what you can find because there's just not that much stuff exposed directly to the internet. So you send emails, you trick people into clicking on links and you exploit their browser, you exploit the word processing application or Microsoft Office or Adobe. Those types of things are more realistic. Now, the exploit we used to do was a FTP server. So FTP server has to be exposed on the network if you want to be able to reach it. But the reason I'm saying all this is because don't think because we're exploiting an application that runs on someone's system and they've got to open up a malicious document to get execution, that that's any different than sending packets across a network to an FTP server. The only difference is one requires the user to do something and the other one does not. Opening up a TCP connection to deliver the payload or the exploit is not really that interesting. It's what is exposed and exploitable. And 99 times out of 100, if not more than that, you're going to rely on a vulnerable application and the user to open up that vulnerable application to get the code execution. Now, the reason I didn't stick with WarFTP is because it didn't work starting on Windows Vista 7, so I had to find a new one that worked all the way through Windows 10 64-bit Enterprise. That means 32-bit and 64-bit Enterprise, Pro, Ultimate, Home, so on and so forth. It had to work on all those different versions. And to find a vulnerable application that not only works on all those different versions, but can be exploited via a basic buffer overflow on the return pointer, a buffer overflow taking control of the structured exception handlers, and the ability to find enough ROP gadgets to disable data execution prevention or change permissions, I should say, that's not an easy ask. And I went to ExploitDB and started downloading all these different vulnerable applications that had exploits. And when I try to port the exploit over to different OSs and such, it would fail. So it took me, I think, a couple weeks, sadly, to find an application that's just so horribly written that you can exploit it so many different ways and get reliability. And this is our application that we'll use as our learning tool. And the vendor was made aware many times over the years that there was a vulnerability. And they still choose, I believe, last I checked, they sell this product with vulnerabilities still inside of them. So that will be our target. And we're going to run this on our Windows 10 system. Our goal first here is to trigger a buffer overflow, determine the buffer size, verify control of the instruction pointer. And we have to get around ASLR because it's on automatically with Windows 10. We can't turn it off. And to do that, we're going to find loaded modules that come with a third-party application that aren't rebased, so therefore we can exploit it. So what I'd recommend if you've got VMware Workstation or Fusion, take a snapshot prior to starting this, prior to installing Blaze application. That way you don't have to deal with the trial version and stuff. If you ever want to revert back to clean state, you can. So a lot of these are going to be instructions just for you. I'm just going to skip through them, but just point a couple things out. Immunity Debugger's already installed. So you don't have to worry about this slide. If you do want to install Immunity on another system, it's got some instructions for you, so you can skip that for now. It's already there for you. Dep exception is already in place. Now, this may or may not be the case, depending on how your system is behaving. We used to have it kind of like a default setting that would turn off dep for this particular application once you install it. But that may or may not work, but it's no big deal. Just check real quickly to see if it's on or off. Dep should be on by default and protecting all services and applications on this Windows 10 version. When you install Blaze, you may need to go into your system control panel dep settings, and I'll show you where that is soon, and put an exception in for Blaze. So double check that to make sure. We want dep to be off for this particular application for now, because we want this to be a basic buffer overflow. Later on in this book, we'll turn dep back on and we'll utilize a ROP chain to change permissions and get around dep, but not yet. So this is going to tell you how to go and check that. There's what you're looking for. The may or may not be the same name. And then you're going to bring up Python. So here's where I'm going to switch over to demoing this stuff. And then when you go back through it, you're going to work your way through the exercise through the slides. So I'm going to go over to my Windows 10 system. Now, first thing we'll do is check the control panel settings. So I'm going to go to, actually, I'll just go to control panel and do it this way. So we click on control panel, we click on system and security, and then we click on system, and then click on advanced system settings for performance, and then dep. So here you can see how it says turn on depth for all programs and services except those I select. Now Blaze is in your day 5 Blaze files folder. You're going to install it from here after you take that snapshot. You can see I've already installed it, so I'm not going to reinstall it, but I had not yet set a depth exception up first. So make sure that you do that if it's not there for you already. So I'm going to click add. We're going to go to our program files folder, x86, because this is a 32-bit application on a 64-bit OS, so it's using SysWow 64. We'll go to Blaze Video, Professional, and I'm just going to go down and find the executable. So right there is the executable. We'll say open, and we add that exception in. It may call itself something different, but we know we did it right. And now we've got an exception. Depp will not be running for that application. We click apply, okay, and just close all this stuff out for now. So next up, what we want to do is bring up the Python editor here, and you may or may not have a Blaze1py file already on your system. If you don't, you just got to create it. Either way, you can create it from scratch if you want. We're going to say edit with idle, and now we've got the contents open. You can see it says create a file called blaze1.plf. X is a variable, open a file in writable permission. Payload equals 8 × 1000, and then write that payload to the file and close it. That's all we're doing. We're creating a file with a PLF playlist file extension and putting 1000 A's in it. Once we do that, go ahead and run the script, and that should create a file called blaze1.plf on your system. So I think I just did the wrong thing. Let's just go and hit F5. And we'll run that, and there we created the Blaze1 PLF file. You can see it's right there now in my folder. Next thing we're going to do is just bring up Blaze, the application, but we want to attach to it with a debugger. So watch how I do this, because it's going to avoid some annoying issues like exceptions being caught by the debugger and having to add exceptions to the exceptions list in the debugger. So you're going to start up Blaze, so I double click on it. Here's the trial thing, just say later and let it come up. So here's what the application looks like. It's a video player. We're going to click on the folder icon to open playlist, then click on the PLF file, but don't open it. Just click on it, but don't click open. We're getting it to the point where we attach to the debugger right before we open the file, so we don't have to deal with any other runtime garbage. Then we bring up Immunity. And then we click on File, Attach, click on Blaze, and say Attach. It's going to take a moment, so give it a moment to do its thing. Once it does its thing, go ahead and click F9 to continue, to let it run. It's running, so let's go over to Blaze, and let's click Open. We click Open, and look what the instruction pointer says, 41414141. So we clearly overwrote a return pointer and real easily or real quickly got control of this process. So a really basic buffer overflow there. And if you see on the stack, see all those A's there? So we don't really know how big the buffer size is because it's just a ton of A's right now. So what we want to do is go and change this to a pattern. If we use the Metasploit pattern create script, and we'll do that with Mona here, we should be able to then go in and see how big the buffer is. That would be our next logical step. So first thing I'm going to do is simply go and use the Mona command to do this. Now look on the C drive, there's a Mona output folder already created for you. You can create that with a command with Mona. I believe it's a Mona config minus set working folder, and then you type it where you want it to point to. It's going to dump the results of any Mona commands that we run to that location. So down in the command prompt, I'm just going to say Mona PC for pattern create. And I'll create a pattern of 600 bytes here. And when we run that, let me just change the font size in this log window. You can see it says, I know it's hard to read, but it says creating cyclic pattern, and it gives you this pattern, but it says don't copy it from here. It may be truncated. Go get it from the Mona output folder where it was written. So I'm going to close the debugger. Make sure you close the debugger every time after the program crashes, and make sure the program is dead too. Otherwise, you get into some problems. So we're going to go to the Mona output folder, and you can see there's a Blaze HDTV folder now created by Mona. We grab pattern.txt. We're going to grab the ASCII pattern here, copy it. We're going to go back to our exploit, and change A times 1,000, paste in the pattern, save it, and then run that. And now we've created a new blaze file with the pattern. Repeat the steps from previously. We bring up the player, accept the NAG screen. Once it comes up, you're going to click on the folder icon, open playlist, and then click on the file, but don't open it. Go to immunity, and then we're going to attach again. So immunity's up. We attach to blaze. Wait for it. Takes a moment. And this time, when it attaches, we're going to let it run with F9. We're going to open the playlist file, and we should see the pattern now appear. So we do that, and you can see EIP says 37694136. That's a piece of the pattern. So we're going to copy that address, and we're going to go down to the prompt at the bottom of immunity, Mona pattern offset, PO, paste that in, and it comes back and says, found at position 260. So 260 bytes gets us to the return pointer. So great, we learned that. So next thing we're going to do, I'm going to close the debugger, make sure it's all dead. We're going to change the pattern back to A times 260. 260 plus, now I'm going to put in something like dead code so that we see it. If we get control, we know we're precise. Plus hex 90 times 20 plus hex CC times 20. And the reason I'm doing that is so it lays it out nicely on the screen for us visually. And also another thing I'm going to show you in a moment. So repeating our steps, we created the file again after we saved it. I think I saved it. Let me just double check. All right, just in case. So Blaze is now up later on the NAG screen. It's the annoying part about debugging. You've got to repeat your steps over and over again. So folder, open, click on the file, but don't open it. Immunity, and then attach. This time, we should expect to see that the instruction pointer will point to dead code if we did this correctly. So I'm just waiting for it to load, and then we'll hit F9, open playlist, and then right there, dead code in the instruction pointer. Now what's more important here is the stack pane. If you look at the stack pane, you see the A's, the four ones, and then you see dead code up there, and then you see nine zeros for like 32 bytes of them. And the stack pointer points all the way down a bunch of double words. Like you would expect if we ret to dead code that the stack pointer would point to the next address after that, right? To the first set of nops. But it doesn't. It points way further. The reason for that, if some of you probably already guessed, is that there must have been arguments pushed onto the stack for this function call, whatever it is. And therefore there was like a ret 10 or ret 14, a ret to the dead code return pointer and then adjust the stack pointer some number of bytes further to compensate to get around those old arguments. That's a calling convention cleanup code. So that's why it's doing that. So we don't want to start our shell code any earlier than where the stack pointer would point now, because what we want to do now is find a non-ASLR participating DLL and locate a jump ESP opcode. If we can locate a jump ESP opcode and overwrite that instead of dead code, when it rets, it'll ret to wherever the stack pointer is pointing, and that's where we want to put our shellcode at. So that's why we need to make sure that we put 16 bytes of padding before we start our shellcode because of that calling convention cleaning up the arguments. So pretty neat to point that out. So let's go find a module that doesn't participate in ASLR. So we say Mona modules minus O. That means show me the modules and the exploit mitigations. Exclude any operating system modules. Let me change the color here to black on white. And these are all the modules that come with Blaze. And you can see most of them don't participate in exploit mitigations. And specifically, I'm going to go ahead and use the one configuration.dll that's right there, up there with false, 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 no mitigations. And we're going to say Mona jump minus register or R ESP minus M for module configuration.dll. Let this run for a moment. If it jumps back to the main screen like it just did for me, it's still searching. So it looks like it's hanging. Give it a moment. It's parsing through all that code to see if it can find the right opcodes. And it switched me back to the main window. Click on L for log view. And you can see found a total of 4 pointers. So I'm just going to grab one of these jump ESPs. Any of them should work. I'll grab this address. And then we're going to close the debugger. And I'm going to say at the top here, import struct. Because we want to pack this variable. And I'll say variable, I'll call it jump ESP equals struct. This is Python 2.7 still. Dot pack. And then little endian. And then paste in the address. So we're now going to change dead code to that variable, jump ESP. And that packing is just converting it to little endian format for us so we don't have to write it in reverse order. And we're going to also go and grab shell code because we're almost ready to go here. And this shell code will just spawn up a command prompt. So I'm going to copy that and we'll paste that into our exploit as well. And instead of CC times 20, we're going to put in the variable shell code and save that. So I'm going to set a breakpoint on the jump ESP address and we'll see if we can get this thing working. So we saved it, we run it, and we repeat our earlier steps. Click on folder, open, as soon as it comes up, there we go. All right, immunity, attached to Blaze, give it a moment, and when it comes up this time, I'm gonna let it continue, and then I'm gonna do a control G to go to the address of the jump ESP, so I can set a breakpoint. So control G, paste that in. Now I hit enter and it didn't take me to the right spot. Sometimes for whatever reason, you gotta do it twice. And there we are, jump ESP. We hit F2 to set a breakpoint and we're good. Now we go and open this up. Now it says breakpoint hit. So look at the stack pane. You can see we hit the breakpoint and the instruction pointer is at that address we overwrote the return pointer with of the jump ESP. Then we have those knobs in there. So we're gonna, if we jump the ESP, I'm gonna hit F7, watch the disassembler pane. You could see we made it to our knobs and we slide down the knob sled. And then we hit F9 and we get a shell that pops up. So we got the exploit working. Now, if dep was on, that would have stopped us from being successful because we couldn't execute code on the stack. But that is your exercise. You may have to go back and listen to this a couple of times. You may have to play around with it and struggle through some things. The book and the instructions and the notes has some gotchas and if you run into some problems, it should tell you about those problems and what you need to compensate for with. Hopefully yours goes as smoothly as mine, but it's not such a bad thing to run into problems because these things don't always work perfectly out of the box. So go ahead and complete this exercise and then we'll pick back up with the structured exception handling overwrite exercise. Okay, at this point you should have completed the basic stack overflow exercise and ready to move on to the structured exception handling overwrite exercise. Just wanted to point out, because I believe I forgot to in the last section as well, Mona is a tool from a good friend of mine, Corland Coder, or Peter van Ickhout out of Belgium. It's named after his daughter and it's a fantastic tool that has ported over a lot of really great exploit development tools, like you saw, for example, pattern create and pattern offset, as well as a custom ROP generator, like ROP gadget finder and ROP chain builder tool and ton of other stuff in there, and also ported over to Windebug as well. So that's why we're using that tool. So let's move on now to the structured exception handling overwrite portion, but we're using the same target program again. And remember I said, this is a nice thing about this one, is that we can overwrite the return pointer, but we can also overwrite the structured exception handler and get control as well. Now you might be saying, well, if we can get control of the return pointer and do it that way, why care about structured exception handling overwrites? And that's a good question, and there's also a really great answer to that, and we're going to talk about it soon. So your goal for this one, though, is to overwrite the handler and utilize a pop-pop-ret gadget trick that we'll talk about when we get there, and get around the safe SEH protection by identifying a module that doesn't participate in both ASLR and also safe SEH. And if you remember, we saw configuration.dll and some other ones pretty much don't participate in any of them, so we shouldn't have any issue there.